ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
Australia's alliance with the United States has been the linchpin of our country's foreign policy for decades.
We value the unbroken friendship between the Australian and the American peoples.
But between the wars and the tariffs and the unpredictability, are we growing apart?
You know who else didn't help us? Australia.
Join me, Hamish McDonald.
And me, Geraldine Doogue, as we ask, do we still need the alliance? Search for Global Roaming on ABC Listen or wherever you get your podcasts.
Your favourite book countdown is back. Yes, voting is now officially open for ABC Radio National's Top 100 Books. And this is The Book Show. I'm Claire Nichols. And we want to know, what are your favourite ever Australian books? Sarah Lestrange, what kind of books are we talking about?
Everything and anything, as long as it is Australian. Very broad. So it's fiction, non-fiction, you know, romance lovers, we want to hear from you, crime readers, cookbook connoisseurs. And, of course, we want your favourite Australian classics as well. History, memoir, biography. I think you get the idea.
It can be anything.
Anything, yeah.
And you can vote from today. We will then count up the votes for the live countdown on the weekend of the 17th and 18th of October here on ABC Radio National. I can't wait for that.
I know. It's my favourite time of year. And to vote, it's pretty simple. If you did it last year, you'll know. You just need to go to the ABC Radio National website and you can choose up to 10 books. And if you're struggling, there is an inspiration guide, you know, if you need help with remembering book titles or author names.
But I should say, if your favourite book isn't on the inspiration list, you can still include it in the vote. You've just got to enter it manually. You have a few weeks to get voting, but don't sleep on this. Will you be voting, Sarah?
Yeah, I think so. It's in the job description. I love voting in elections and for books.
What will you be voting for?
Well, today I will be voting for, Elizabeth Harrower's The Watchtower. It's kind of domestic gothic at its finest, and it's dark, it's brooding, it's quite emotionally difficult. Yeah, so The Watchtower by Elizabeth Harrower.
Okay, that's your current number one.
Yeah. Now, are you going to surprise me with your choice, Claire?
I don't think I'm going to surprise you. I'm going to talk about Cloud Street, of course, by Tim Winton. I'm a West Australian and I just don't know that there's a better novel almost ever.
Well, you know, I have been listening to the audiobook and I am loving it. So it is so deserved.
I've read it so many times. I can't get enough of it. But to kick off the Top 100 Australian Books vote, Sarah, you have sat down with some fabulous guests at the Melbourne Writers' Festival in front of a live audience.
Yeah, can you believe it? I had the author Maxine Benieba Clark, the newly crowned Miles Franklin Literary Award winner, Omar Musa, and the actor Nadine Garner, who you know from the Henderson Kids and maybe the Dr. Blake mysteries. So very exciting panel.
Yeah, real star power there. So we're going to start by finding out about the Australian books they were reading as kids.
Yeah, and we'll start with Maxine Benieba Clark. She's a poet, children's book author and illustrator. She's the author of the much-loved memoir, The Hate Race. You and I both love that book. Mm-hmm. And the award-winning book of short stories, Foreign Soil, which is taught in schools. And her latest book is Beautiful Changelings. Maxine, do you naturally reach for Australian titles in your reading?
Yeah, I definitely do. I think because I'm looking for the work of my contemporaries. But also, you know, I grew up in a time where I feel like Australian writing was just coming into fruition. There was still that kind of slight cultural cringe about an Australian narrative. And still, I guess, grappling with the idea of what is an Australian story. So now it's something that I kind of naturally gravitate towards, but for a while here it was a deliberate choice to reach for Australian stories.
And Maxine is sounding a bit croaky because she's been doing spoken word events and talking to kids, so she's been working really hard for these last few weeks. Lucky kids, I reckon. And Nadine Garner, okay, who grew up watching The Henderson Kids? Woo! Yes, me too. It's funny how the books we read and the TV we see as kids really stays with us, right? But of course, Nadine has done so much more. You've seen her on the screen for the Dr. Blake Mysteries. She's won a Best Actress at the 1988 Australian Film Institute Awards, has appeared in many, many TV roles and on the stage. Nadine, are you a patriotic reader?
I think being an actor that's very dedicated to Australian storytelling, I tell Australian stories more on screen and on stage than I do reading privately. So I think I am tending toward more Australian literature now because I'm trying to understand who we are now, because I think we're kind of a society in massive change. And so I tend to kind of look out and listen out for the voices in Australia writing, Australian writing that I should be listening to. Across my life, I don't know if I've privileged it. I think I have to thank schools for privileging Australian literature at times. I think they've done a good job with that. Have they always chosen the right voices? I'm not sure.
And Omar Musa, he's a visual artist, a poet, spoken word performer, playwright, novelist, short story writer, rapper. Did I miss anything, Omar?
No, that's about it.
Yeah?
Scallywag.
And Omar's the author of two novels, Here Come the Dogs, and his latest is Fierce Land. Do Australian subjects and authors shape what you read?
Yeah, definitely. I think a lot of my work's in conversation with my contemporaries, like Maxine. Our first books came out in exactly the same year. So we've been sort of bouncing our work off each other for a long time. But I feel really lucky to have sort of come of age in this era of Australian literature. But I think also as a kid, you know, schools definitely did privilege some amazing young adult authors when I was growing up in the 90s. And yeah, I'm looking forward to discussing those in a little bit.
Yeah, well, so great. So please give everyone a big round of applause. So I want to take a tour through your reading lives to find out what Australian books have sustained you from childhood to now. Because as I mentioned, there's this strong emotional connection we have to books we read as children. And I'm very attached to books that I've read to my children. Omar, so you come from a family steeped in poetry and performance and writing. Your dad's a poet, your mum's in theatre. So what were you reading as a kid?
I was really lucky to grow up in an artistic household that really valued reading and going to the library. And actually in Queanbeyan, where I grew up, there was an old secondhand bookshop just on the other side of the block. So I remember my parents used to take me there, and you know, books were like 50 cents or $1 in those days. So my parents would sometimes give me a little $2 coin and be like, oh, you know, go crazy on what you want to buy. I remember they gave me The Monster That Ate Canberra, being a proud Queanbeyanite and growing up in Canberra. That made me feel, you know, very proud of where I was from. And, you
so
know,
this
the,
is
Bunyip,
an illustrated
the Bunyip
book.
Was like the original, the OG outsider in Australia. So I could really relate to that Bunyip, you know, turning up, being, you know, voraciously hungry, wanting to eat Parliament House. I've been sort of trying to do that ever since in my writing. I was a big fan of the magic pudding. I think also because I was a glutton, I loved the idea of an ever-replenishing
So this is Norman Lindsay?
Pudding. Yeah, Norman Lindsay, 1912, I believe. Yeah, I remember loving those, and the fact that they were really Australian and local was something that resonated with me. And then I remember my father giving me lots of folk tales from around Asia, but also giving me some Aboriginal Dreamtime stories, like Tiddalik, the frog that drank all the water, and then some from far north Australia, from Cape York, the Quinkin stories, and I'm finding those like really, really scary. But all of those things together, I remember, just really got my imagination inflamed, and I just loved reading them, especially because they were local.
Yeah. And Nadine, you grew up in Melbourne in the eastern suburbs.
Yep.
Is there a book that stayed with you? You mentioned primary school before. Is there a book that stayed with you from primary school?
Yeah, I'm just listening to Omar. I'm just remembering those cosy times in the library in primary school where, you know, you'd go in and there'd be this beautiful sort of safe place and you'd sit on the floor and the librarian would sit there and read you a book. And I think those days have gone. Like, I think we don't have, maybe the kids don't have that sense of safety or wonder in libraries the way they used to. And I don't want to sit here and talk about, you know, the old world and all is lost. But I do have such fondness for the magic my librarian, Mrs. Rand, she'd sit there with her pearls and her glasses, and she'd just open books, and it just felt so wondrous and amazing. So that was my early childhood. I think there's a book that stayed with me as I became a more mature reader, and that was Playing Beattie Bo by Ruth Park. It was one of those first books that sort of opened my adult imagination in some ways. It was a kind of coming-of-age book, but it was also kind of magic realism. And it was just not always the book that Ruth Park is remembered for, but was certainly really impactful for me, yeah.
Yeah, so we remember Harp in the South. And, I mean, Ruth Park was, I think she was born in New Zealand, but, you know, we in Australia, we like to take on other
inherit, yeah, we like to claim them.
Especially New Zealanders, but definitely capturing Australia in many of its parts, yeah. And Maxine, what about you? Because you've written and illustrated children's books. So what books were you drawn to as a child?
Yeah, it's funny. My mum rang me a couple months ago and she said, I was in the local library and I saw this little Indian Australian girl with this massive stack of books. And you know when you can only borrow 20 and you have to cull them? She said, I went up and I said, you remind me of my, you know, my youngest daughter, and she's a writer now. And I'm thinking, these poor people. Mum's having this nostalgic trip down memory lane and they're just trying to borrow books. But yeah, I was obsessed with libraries as a kid and obsessed with reading. I remember in terms of picture books, the three that stick out are Possum Magic. And it's funny because my mum's an actor, and a few years ago, just post-pandemic, she got the role of Grandma Poss in the stage adaptation. And I hadn't read the book for ages, and I went to the kind of opening, and just to see these kids respond to the story, and I didn't remember what I loved about the story, and just realising, you know, the possum gets turned invisible. And then she kind of is like, Grandma, I want to be visible again. Just the profoundness of not being seen, and thinking of my story as a kid being, you know, a black migrant kid and feeling like you're not seen. And it was only as an adult watching my mum play out this, you know, gorgeous story for this room full of kids, I was like, okay, that's why I love the story. Another one, which is one I've brought, The Tram to Bondi Beach, illustrated by Julie Vivas, who illustrated Possum Magic. And again, I reread this once Sarah asked me to do this panel, and it's almost like an adult short story. It's about this kid, Kieran O'Grady, who's obsessed with trams. And it's set, written in 1981, and I was born in 79, so obviously came out at just the right time for me. And he's obsessed with trams, and he's obsessed with this big boy. You know, Kieran's like maybe 13 or something. He's obsessed with this big boy who gets to sell newspapers on the tram. And he kind of, you know, winds through the outside of the tram, and he's hanging onto the railings, and finally he gets this job, you know, working the trams, and the big boy, Saxon, I think his name is so mean to him. It's like, this is my turf, and, you know, you have to stand down there, you can't come on the tram. And it's a really adult, it's almost like an adult short story. So when I read this book, I didn't feel like I was condescended to. And the third one, My Place by Nadia Wheatley, which is a book that kind of looks at one piece of land and the various generations that have lived there.
And I can hear the audience sort of responding to these books that you're talking about, which is really powerful. It's kind of like this shared and collective memory. On ABC Radio National, I'm Sarah Lestrange, discovering the Australian books that have shaped authors Maxine Beniba-Clark, Omar Musa and actor Nadine Garner to inspire you for Radio National's Top 100 Australian Books of All Time countdown. So we've discovered childhood. Let's move on to the teen years. It's when we're expected to read for school, and maybe we start branching out. Nadine, you've been on our television screen since you were 13 in The Henderson Kids. Was there much time for reading?
Oh, I think so. I have spent a lot of time in my life reading and learning scripts. And sometimes I'm part of a little book club with some friends of mine, and, you know, their reading is so broad and profound. And I actually think I've read less than other people who love books, because a great deal of my time is devoted to learning texts. Sometimes I've wondered whether those texts that I've been immersed in have actually dictated parts of my life.
Oh, and like what?
So when I was 16, 17, I made a film called Mull, which was based on a Bron Nichols book called Mull Away, which is a coming-of-age book set in St Kilda about just a regular girl trying to hold her life together. Her mum's dying of cancer and she gets thrust into motherhood, having to look after her two younger siblings. And I, after making that film, I then went on to live in St Kilda. I sometimes look at my life and go, are the texts that I'm performing writing my life? I know that sounds a little glib, but I have just reflected on that and thought, you know, there's a profound relationship I have to texts, and it's not just a novel that I read. I actually embody the texts and I perform them, and then they tell me how to live my life. So it's an interesting counterpoint that I'm not a writer, but in some ways the books write me in a way. So it's a profound love I have for texts and a profound relationship that I have to them, yeah.
And you mentioned your reading was influenced, of course, by what was suggested in at school. Was there any books that were coming up through school that you were reading from that time, like Sally Morgan?
Yeah, Sally Morgan's My Place is obviously a text that still just makes me cry because of the profound sadness of that story and the immense importance of that voice in 1987 when it was published, that we hadn't heard that Indigenous story before. And revisiting that text, I just think it's told with such grace that there's no malice, there's no hatred, there's just a laying bare of the facts of how Indigenous peoples were treated back in the 30s and 40s, and the very beautiful, you know, the detail in the recollections that are just published for us just to think on. There's such generosity in that text, and it still should be on the syllabus, I think. It's a profound piece of historical writing, yeah.
Maxine and Omar, what about you? Were you reading books by Indigenous authors through school? Like, were these on the curriculum? Like, Omar, your father was suggesting stories, but what about through school?
No, I mean, I was really lucky. I had some amazing primary school. I had an amazing primary school English teacher, Ms. Patterson. So shout out to her. I think she probably would be listening into this.
Oh, great. Hi, Ms. Patterson, wherever you are.
Yeah. She was amazing, actually, because I don't know why, but she identified some little element of talent in me in these, like, really gory horror stories that I would write. And she started directing me a little bit more towards poetry. But I don't think at that time Indigenous stories were as much part of the curriculum as far as I can remember. But I'm thinking a bit more, like, I really liked Isabel Carmody in those times. Oba Newton, I remember Scatterlings that she wrote. That
was so these are fantasy novels?
These are more fantasy ones. So, those Indigenous stories weren't coming out, I think, again, and didn't surface again for me in terms of reading until university, sadly. And so in those sort of late primary school, early teen years, yeah, I think those fantasy books of Isabel Carmody. I remember with Scatterlings, it was funny, I had to actually go back on Wikipedia and look at it because I remember that was the first time when everyone was reading Oba Newton, I was like, oh, no, I'm a Scatterlings fan, you know. Like, I'd done a bit more obscure reading and that was the first time where I was, like, a bit stoked to have dug beneath the surface into someone's, you know, into the more obscure catalogue. And then Gary Crew, No Such Country and Strange Objects. I remember because it would have been post-bicentenary.
This was 1988?
So after 1988, I think Australia sort of grappling with what it is, what it should be, its colonial past, the past of dispossession, what type of country we want to be. And so with Strange Objects, I remember it was about a teenage boy who comes across some strange objects, including a kind of cauldron that's got a mummified hand in it and a gold ring. And it was about a Dutch shipwreck on the coast of Australia, and sort of hinted at that it wasn't, you know, in terms of European contact with Australia, it wasn't actually the British that were first in contact with Australia. But then it also dealt with dispossession and violence and that kind of clash and friction between European and Aboriginal Australia. And I think Gary Crew, that was the first time, that was that sort of intermediate period between being a kid and an adult where I was starting to read more, something more serious, that was multi-layered. Mm-hmm.
Thanks again, Miss Patterson, for taking you on this different path. And Maxine, one of the reasons I connected with your memoir, The Hate Race, was because you take us back to the schoolyard in the 1980s. We're about the same age, to a time when friendship is everything, but also dealing with bullying. Is there a book set in school that you loved as a teen?
I distinctly remember reading My Place and Looking for Alibrandi around the same time. I think Looking for Alibrandi came out about 92. So I would have been 12 when it came out, and then My Place 1987, but I read them both when I was about 15 or so. And I did not... They were the first books I read that were an Australian narrative that wasn't an Anglo narrative. And it was kind of a real, like, key moments in my literary life when I saw Melina Marchetta in a green room. I feel like I almost fainted. I don't even think I spoke to her. And then meeting Anne Boleyn Que Mulliner, who's an author, who's Sally Morgan's daughter, like, oh my gosh, you know. And so it's kind of those were moments for me where I was like, I've done the thing, you know. I always wanted to write my story into the kind of Australian dialogue. And I think this story, you know, set in a high school, 17-year-old protagonist, Italian background, you know, you have the two love interests, the private school boy and the rough working class. And it's just like, it just has all the ingredients of good teenage fiction and of not condescending to teenagers when you're writing, and understanding that teenagers are thinking about love and life and sex and politics, and, you know, it doesn't have to be a child story. So those were the two books for me that made me think, okay, maybe one day there'll be space for my story. And I started to go looking for stories within that canon kind of in early adulthood.
And now, Maxine, you're on the other side. You're going into schools talking to kids about your books, Foreign Soil, and all your wonderful books of poetry for kids. What's that like, being on the other side?
Yeah, it's pretty strange. particularly, I've had the good fortune of having two books on the VCE syllabus in the state where I live, right? So as a consequence, you just get so many school invites. You know, you realise that The Hate Race, my memoir, even though it's set in the 80s and 90s, the way Australian kids respond to an Australian narrative, you know, that has meat pies and Chico rolls and, you know, going down the creek to catch tadpoles, and maybe they're past that in 2026, but they still have memories or their parents talk about those kinds of things. But also being able to pull in the narratives that I didn't see. Like, well, I think when I was first reading Indigenous narratives, I'll put in air quotes, they were written by Anglo-Australians. Like, that was my first encounter of the Indigenous story. So being able to pull some of that history into my memoir, like, I distinctly remember the Redfern Address and watching that in history class and the different reactions of the students. And the
so this is
of,
Paul know, Keating's Redfern Address?
Yeah, Redfern Address. Address, so where, you know, he apologised for the stolen generation. And I remember Pauline Hanson first coming on the scene and the maidens and kind of going, this is part of the story of Australian teenagehood for me. And so, yeah, it's kind of amazing to go into schools. And even though I wrote this story as a book of unbelonging, in a weird way it's now become this piece of Australiana, you know, because it's all on the school syllabus.
Oh, I have such strong memories of what I was reading as a kid and as a teenager. And I loved hearing about Possum Magic. That was so huge in my house when I was a kid, and it's still huge in my house now that I have a kid. Playing Beatty Bo too, really important to me. But I want to know what books resonate with you. What are you going to vote for in ABC Radio National's Top 100 Australian Books Vote? Sarah, I can't believe no one's mentioned Tomorrow When the War Began yet. When I think of myself as a teenage reader, that was it for me.
Well, you can vote for it, Claire. Voting is open now, and I can't wait to see what books make the countdown. And of course, yes, we know that Cloud Street is your number one favourite book by Tim Winton, but just to remind you all, you've got 10 to choose from. So, you know, make them count.
Yeah, Tomorrow When the War Began will be in for me too. But Sarah, you spoke to Maxine Beneva-Clark, Nadine Garner and Omar Moussa about their childhood and teen reading of Australian books. Where to now?
Well, I think that late teens and early 20s, it can be really formative years for as a reader, because you're finally in charge of what you're reading, the complexity of what you're reading, kind of it expands. And Omar Moussa discovered new books that shaped his adult reading and writing then too.
Yeah, one that really stands out for me was True Country by Kim Scott. I believe it was his first novel published in 93, yeah. So I was studying at the Australian National University, and I did a course on Indigenous literature from Australia and North America with an American professor called Rich Pascal. I remember him really well, actually. Kind of dressed a little bit like a cowboy. He was really tall. He had thick glasses and big, thick sideburns. And this book blew me away because it had these shifting perspectives. Goes from first person to third person without even sort of signposting it. It deals with a young teacher who goes to an outback community, an Indigenous community, and grapples with his own Aboriginality. I believe has an Anglo mother and an Aboriginal father, or vice versa. I'm sorry if I get that wrong. And I just remember I'd read nothing like it because it sort of dipped in and out of Noongar language as well and English, and it just sort of slapped me awake and sort of made me realise maybe what I'd been missing out on in terms of my reading and the types of stories that we needed to read. But I remember that course also, I read Louise Erdrich's work from North America, and I started getting a consciousness around these kind of interconnected global networks and webs as well, of literature, thinking and resistance.
Mm. Because Louise Erdrich is a Native American writer. Maxine, the 90s were a time of grunge, of course, when you were in your 20s or coming into your 20s. What were you reading?
Yeah, so I was away at uni. I did a creative writing degree. I was also studying something else, but University of Wollongong, so kind of like a working class city. And I would go home, and at the time my sister had just finished university. She'd done a communications degree, and she was a publicist at Allen & Unwin. And Allen & Unwin was the home of the grunge-lit bros, you know, Chris Tsiolkas, Andrew McGahan, maybe even Luke Davies might have been Allen & Unwin at the time. And so I would go home for the holidays, and there would just be these stacks of, like, basically young white men writing about living in the grungy city. And of course I was like a young black woman, but I was living in these like awful share houses, you know, at university when you're like struggling to make ends meet and you're all eating the same pot of pasta for the whole week, and, you know, creative arts department, you know, you're kind of like all going to uni bar. And, yeah, exactly. And so it really resonated. And this idea of, I'd come out of high school, I did two English classes at high school, and we'd done utopias and anti-utopias, like Thomas More, George Orwell and Aldous Huxley. We'd done Jane Austen's, so Pride and Prejudice and Emma, and we'd done three Shakespearean comedies, like canon, canon, canon. So even though this was young white men, the grittiness of this literature and the fact that it was contemporary and I could see Australia in it, I think definitely influenced even kind of writing The Hate Race. This idea that, you know, this is the stuff of literature. You know, he died with a falafel in his hand.
John Birmingham. Yeah.
And so I was reading that, but I was also reading the stuff I was being given, you know, which was mostly actually international, a history of Western literature, you know, at university. And then I went to Newcastle Writers Festival. I think we worked out we were there at the same year.
It's very possible.
And I saw a panel with Tara June Winch in conversation with Frank Morehouse, the Australian writer. And he was such a champion of young Australian writers, and he interviewed her about her work. And I remember thinking, she's younger than me, and she's written Swallow the Air, which is this incredible novel in short stories. She won the Miles Franklin a few years ago for The Yield, but this is one of my favourite books. It's a novel in short stories about these two young First Nations kids who lose their mum unexpectedly and go to live with their auntie. And it's difficult, but it's beautiful, like these moments of family and community and country amongst the kind of really difficult life stuff. And I remember just seeing her speak. And years later, I would actually do the Melbourne launch of The Yield, of her novel, which was another like, oh my goodness, it's Tara June Winch moment. And I remember her saying, I was so young and people did not believe I'd written the book, you know, because it's just really, if you get a chance to buy it and read it, I read it again prior to this panel, and even reading it 20 years later, just the line by line, sentence by sentence writing is beautiful.
I mean, we forget that people can write amazing books at any age. Nadine, what about you? Did you have any interests that you were exploring in the books you were reading?
Yeah, in my 20s, I was doing an arts degree at Swinburne and I got very interested in Jean-Paul Sartre. So I read a lot of Sartre and Kafka, and I also read just, 1984 and, the obvious ones. But I also got really intrigued with the Heidi Circle around that time, because I'd run into and became really close friends with someone who ran a gallery with Sweeney Reed, who was Joy Hester's son, who got adopted by lots of nodding in the audience. I'm sure everyone here knows about the Heidi Circle. But I became really interested in that friendship between Joy and Sunday. And, yeah, in fact, I've tried to kind of instigate some dramatisations of that story, but it's a really tricky story to tell because there's so many component parts to it. But there was a book called Dear Son, which was the letters between those two women, and the intriguing friendship set around the birth of Australian modernism, I think, was something that just it really intrigued me at the time. And I was really, really struck by that avant-garde sort of lifestyle that was happening out there at Heidi and what people were exploring. And they were really writing their own rule book out there, or no rule book actually. But from there, there was a birth of a kind of modern movement in art, which I don't think we've surpassed actually, really. I think it remains a great part of our Australian art history. And there was a lot of stuff going on for me in my 20s, some of the canon and then just delving into some very colloquial private letters between women. Yeah. Mm.
And of course, that Heidi group, when you say out there, you mean in Melbourne.
Out there anymore. It felt out there back then.
Yeah, what once was the edge of Melbourne and it was like you were going to the countryside is now maybe not quite in a city, but set on the river and quite a beautiful setting, a beautiful place to visit. Just in case anyone wants to look up that book that you mentioned, Dear Son, because it's S-U-N, The Letters of Joy Hester and Sunday Reed, which is edited by Janine Burke. That's from 1995. And I guess you've mentioned the canon a few times. Maxine, were there books that we've all meant to have read as part of the Australian canon? Were there books that you read at that time and now you look back and go, nah?
Yeah, definitely. Doing a creative writing degree and having a required writing list. My kids went to see that brilliant adaptation of My Brilliant Career. My kids are 15 and 20. Absolutely loved it.
MTC, I saw it too, and it was brilliant.
And I went back to the book for this because my instinct was, I have to find books that are canon and books that are considered, you know, these kind of almost juggernauts of Australian literature in terms of the way we view them now. And I went back to Christina Stead's The Man Who Loves Children. Terrible title. It's not about that, you know. And
it's a man who torments his children.
Yeah. And Miles Franklin's My Brilliant Career. And I was listening to My Brilliant Career, and there was this line where I won't repeat it, but there's a racial slur, there's a slur against people with disabilities, and there's a slur against poets. And I was thinking about the fact that the Stella Prize has been won by a black poet. You know, it's like this kind of revisionism of, yes, it's a wonderful story, but it's a story of its time. And I listened to, with both of them, I don't have copies anymore, so I listened to the audiobook. And The Man Who Loves Children, I was listening to, again, the first chapter. And I went, was that the N-word that I just heard? And I rewound it and I realised that on the recording in production, that sentence had been sped up to about 8 times the speed of the surroundings. Obviously, in post-production, someone went, how are we going to deal with this? We have to have this book. And they would both, in both cases, so easily solved by just having an introduction where you say, this book is a product of its time, you know, yada, 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 you know. And so, you know, although I like both those books for different reasons, I went, you know what, I'm just going to the books, back to the books where I personally had that, oh, wow, you know, this book is incredible and it moves me personally. I'm not going to think about the broader canon because all of those issues come up, of course.
So what do we do with those books that are sexist, racist, homophobic? What do we do with them? Do you have opinion, Omar? Do we stop reading them? Do we just put them to the side? Do we just make sure if we do read them, we read something that's contemporary and does speak to our times?
No, I mean, I personally think it's a little bit false to just try and erase them from history because it sort of contextualizes where we come from and what society we live in and how history echoes. I think it's just really important to contextualize it, maybe with a note at the front or good reading around it, but also potentially, this is a difficult one with literature actually, to, I don't know what the word is, de-expunge other stories that might need to have been read at that time. I know in visual art it's maybe a bit easier to do, for example, like the big macho god monsters, you can do retrospective exhibitions that have their work alongside the amazing women who bolstered their career and were artists in their own right. But maybe with Australian literature, I possibly don't know enough about it because of some of those biases, prejudices, lack of access. It's more difficult to, am I inventing a word, de-expunge other stories
works
that might have been around at that time. But I think it's a really tricky one. Same with kind of monuments and things like that. It's sort of like I think that those things need to be left there, but read in context. Because I think amnesia and willful amnesia is one of our greatest sins as a culture in Australia. So to kind of have that in our reading as well, I think could actually be quite dangerous. Because where we're at right now sort of stems from this inability to grapple with the dark elements of our past. And so we should be able to do that, I think, with our literature.
And I think I think as well, you know, language moves on and progress is inevitable. Like my work is studied in schools today. I have no doubt that in 50 years' time, there might be a preamble in my work. You know, that is just the nature of progress in an evolving world.
Another key area where we see Australian stories and adaptations is on the stage and screen. Of course, in recent years, there have been stage adaptations of Boy Swallows Universe by Trent Dalton, The Weekend by Charlotte Wood, Pip Williams' Dictionary of Lost Words. On TV, there's also been Boy Swallows Universe, Richard Flanagan's Narrow Road to the Deep North. Nadine, how important is it for us to see Australian stories on our screens and even better if they're adapted from Australian books?
Well, it's the most important thing we can fight for at the moment. Well, there's so many things to fight for. Australian stories and all the multiple voices is one of the pivotal things, I reckon. We're at a tipping point in Australia. And I think I fight for this with my work with the union, with the MEAA, to try and lobby the government to create space for and funding for Australian stories to be told. When we do see a Narrow Road to the Deep North come through, we all love it and we all celebrate it. It's just that we don't have enough of them, you know, and we have so many incredible storytellers whose work should be being dramatised and available for us to consume. I think it's a government issue. I think we have to get behind ourselves as a culture and lobby the government to get behind us so that we can fund our own voices. And I think unless we fight for it, it'll disappear.
And so, Maxine and Omar, what Australian books would you like to see brought to the screen or the stage?
I think The White Girl by Tony Birch. I actually think it might be in the works, maybe. I feel like a lot of his stories, even The Butcher's Wife in Shadowboxing, that I was going to say, one of my absolute favourite Australian books of all time.
Maxine, what book would you like to see brought to the stage?
Oh, so many. Unpolished Gem, Alice Pung. Here Come the Dogs, Omar's first verse novel, I think would make an incredible adaptation.
Well, and interestingly, those 90s books that you mentioned, Loaded, Died with a Falafel in His Hand, Praise by Andrew McGann, these books have all been adapted to the screen.
That was how I came across a lot of these books, was seeing them on the screen first.
This has been such an amazing conversation and we are at the end. Thank you so much.
Wow, there are so many great recommendations there for you as you come up with your list to vote in ABC Radio National's Top 100 Australian Books.
And I just want to thank Maxine Beniba-Clark, Omar Musa and Nadine Garner, who spoke to me, Sarah Lestrange, at the Melbourne Writers' Festival. And I'll add their favourite Australian book selections to the show notes of this episode of The Book Show. Claire, how is your list looking after hearing from these fabulous readers?
Oh gosh, every time you hear a book, you cross out one you've had on your list, you add another one in. But I do love thinking about the books that have mattered to you at different points in your life. And I think that's certainly going to be reflected in my votes. I'm taking a bit of a chronological approach. And Sarah, I can submit my votes today if I want to, because voting is now open for the top 100 Australian books. Tell us how we do it.
Go to the Radio National website to cast your vote and get your friends and family to as well. You can vote for 10 books, but you can only do it one time.
Well, Sarah, thank you very much. I loved that conversation. And of course, that was recorded on the lands of the Wurundjeri people. My name is Claire Nichols, and we are going to keep the conversation going about great Australian books, because starting next week, I'm going to bring you interviews with four of Australia's greatest living writers as they reflect on their classic Australian novels. And we are starting next time with Helen Garner and Monkey Grip. It is going to be fantastic. So come back for that. And in the meantime, get voting for your top 100 Australian books.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.